Just let your body relax. Take a few deep breaths just to get yourself into a comfortable, relaxed position. See if you can just let your mind relax. When your mind is relaxed, not bothered, it is naturally, it has a natural sense of well-being, a natural sense of peacefulness, warmth, love. A natural sense of all is well with me. When the mind is relaxed, as I get to know myself, the conscious being, the stable self that I am, my mind learns how to simply relax in the presence of my own being, because the wholeness or the well-being is really the nature of the self, and when the mind relaxes, it enjoys that wholeness, that sense of well-being and wholeness. So the mind learns how to simply relax into that wholeness, which is your nature. But until that self is clearly owned by the mind, recognized, the mind can get itself entangled in all kinds of feelings and anxieties and hurts. It can be self-critical, self-judgmental, self-demeaning. It can fall into all kinds of habits that actually create tension in the mind and unrest. When that's the case, just as a critical voice or a demeaning voice that is external to you causes stress, so too an internal voice causes pain and stress. And on the other hand, just as a friend or a caring voice that is external can bring about great relaxation and peace, a caring internal voice, talking to yourself in a way that is friendly or warm or compassionate or objective, that voice can also will also allow the mind to relax. There's no need to even bring in such a caring voice. unless there happens to be a non-caring and uncaring one there. A caring voice can neutralize and help an uncaring voice. There is no need to bring in an inner friend if you already are that. If your inner environment is already relaxed, non-judgmental, accommodating, then I don't need to bring in an attitude to help the mind gain that relaxation. So you let your body and mind relax. Just notice the inner space, the inner attitude. Is your inner space comfortable? Can you relax internally? Do you feel cared for? Or loved? Whole? One gets to know oneself, if the mind is feeling hurt or uncared for or unloved, it can just simply relax into the self. If there's pressure in the mind, things that need to be said, feelings that need to be vented, if the mind needs to be listened to, then you can easily do that also. you can be a friend. Your mind can be a friend to your mind. Om Sahana Bhavatu, Sahana Punaktu, Sahaviryam Karavavahai, Tejasvinavati Tamastu Mavidvishavahai. Om Shanti Shanti Shanti. We're on verse 10. Kanachana Trishtira Kanachana Markam Kanachana Trishtira Kanachana Markam Yata Nishprapam Manyate Chati Mudaha Yata Nishprapam Manyate Chati Mudaha Tata Baddhavad Pati Yomuta Drishtehe Tata Baddhavad Pati Yomuta Drishtehe Sanityo palabdhi swarupo hamatma. Sanityo palabdhi swarupo hamatma. Sandhi. Kana chana. That's an extra cha in there. You don't know that sandhi rule yet for the Sanskrit students, but it's a duplication of the cha. So the sandhi is actually gana chana drishtihi gana chanam Arkam. Yata Nishprabham Manyate Cha Atimuddha. Tata Buddhavat Bhati Yaha Muda Drishtehe Saha Nitya Upalabdi Swarupaha Aham Atma. So it's really picking up from the last verse. So Kincha, he introduces the verse Kincha, means further. He says, Yata, just as Ghanna Channa Drishtihi, one who's drishti means one who's vision, one who's sight. Channa is covered, Ghanna, by clouds. Ghanna are clouds. Ghanna Channa covered. Ghanna Channa covered by clouds. Drishtihi. Ghanna Channa Drishtihi. Yata, just as one whose vision is covered by clouds. Ghanna Channam Arakam, the sun. The Arka, the sun, which is covered by clouds. Okay. See that where it says Ghanachanam Arakam? The Arka, the sun, which is Ghanachanam, which is covered by clouds, Nishprabham Manyate, is taken to be, is considered to be Nishprabham, without light. The sun has lost its light. Okay. Cha is just a filler in the verse. Ati Muddha. The one who is really very badly deluded. Muddha, right, means one who's deluded. Ati. At this upasarga, it's a little preposition. It means just extremely, on all sides. The person's, you know, very, very deluded. So just as a really deluded person thinks that the sun has lost its light, isn't it? Has become nishprabham, without any light. That deluded person whose vision is covered by the clouds, right? Then that person whose vision is covered by clouds sees the sun, which is covered by clouds, as something which has lost its light. Nish means without, prabham, right? Without light. Okay. Just as a deluded person might think like this, tata, similarly, buddhavat bhati yaha mudadrishtehe, just as the one who, bhati, appears as though bound, buddhavat, vat, right? Vat is an indeclinable that attaches onto nouns, and it will mean like, just means either. So buddhavat, as though bound. So just as that one who appears to be bound, mudra drishtehe, for the one whose drishti, vision, is deluded, right? The one whose vision is deluded. So for that one, in the same way that one who sees a cloud and who can't see the sun because of the clouds in the way thinks that now the sun has lost its luster. Similarly, that one who seems to be bound, right, the self that seems to be bound, for one who, the same way, for one who, whose vision is deluded. That self who is what? So it says, Saha Nitya Upalabdhi Swarupaha Aham Atma. Remember, Hastamalika was asked by Shankara, you know, who are you? And he has answered verse after verse. Every verse ends in this line, this last line that says, Saha Nitya Upalabdhi Swarupaha Aham Atma. I am that Atma whose swarupa, whose nature is nitya upalabdhi, consciousness. Upalabdhi means consciousness, which is nitya. So I am the self whose nature is changeless, timeless. Nitya means timeless, free from any time, so changeless. Right? Timeless means has to be changeless. So I am that conscious being. I am that self whose swarupa, whose nature is consciousness, which is nitya, free from time. So I am that changeless consciousness who appears to be bound, right? The one who, yaha, right? Saha, I am that Atma, yaha, who, buddhavat bhati, who appears as though bound, right? Who shines as though, so we say appears, appear because of the vat, who appears to be bound, to the one whose vision is deluded, right? Just as the sun appears to have lost its light because of the intervening clouds, you know? For one who doesn't know. Okay. So that's the verse this verse, it's a beautiful verse because it should just ground you right into yourself. It should ground you in your experience. But the way of looking at the verse has to be clear. It's like this. I am the sun illumining the clouds of the mind. I am the sun, right? I illumine the clouds of the mind. I illumine the clear skies of the mind. I illumine the thunderstorms of the mind. Right? Whatever the vritti of the mind is, whatever the mood, whatever the emotion, I illumine that. Right? At no time do I not illumine it, and no time am I covered by what I illumine. Right? And so say, I am on the other side of the mind. What does that mean? Because that's what we have to understand from this verse. How can I be on the other side of the mind, looking at the self from the other side of the mind? Okay. Because from the standpoint of knowledge, from the standpoint of reality, just like the sun never loses its luster, it never changes at all, no matter how thick or how dense the clouds are. It doesn't make any difference to the sun. The sun illumines those clouds, it never loses its luster doing so. But say you are on the other side of the clouds, right, looking up at the sun, and now maybe you can see just the dullest, dimmest orb of the sun through the clouds. Or you can't even see the sun at all, and so you think the sun has been lost, the sun is gone. You're on the other side of the clouds. And you don't know what the relationship is of the sun to the clouds and to you. You have no idea. Right? And so for you in your supreme ignorance, extraordinary ignorance for somebody living in this world, right? That would be extraordinary ignorance, or the ignorance of a small child, you know? But this extraordinary phenomenon that you could actually think that the sun has lost its luster, you know? Here, in this situation, we are the sun, you, the Nitya Upalabdhi Srupa, the conscious being that you are, you're the me, the conscious self, that illumines every single thought in the mind, right? The dark thoughts, the happy thoughts, the agitated thoughts, it doesn't make any difference what the thought is. It makes no difference what the emotion is. It makes no difference how dark the emotion is or how light the emotion is. If it's a dark emotion, you are lighting that up. If it's an agitated emotion, you are lighting that up. If it's a pure, blissful emotion, you are lighting that up. And you, the one that is lighting it up, is not changed by whatever it is. From the most sublime, blissful scenery, right? Clear skies, to the darkest, they are all lit by you. Who is the one standing on the other side saying, myself has disappeared? That is the ego. That is the ahankara. By what we mean by ego, that is the ahankara. That is the I notion, that born of self-ignorance, which labels not having differentiated the sun from the mind, not having differentiated me, the consciousness, from the mind, then says, I am the dark cloud. I have become the dark cloud. Right? I have become the agitated rain. I have become the clear skies. That's the one on the other side. Right? That's on the other side of what? It's really on the other side of ignorance. Right? It's self-ignorance. Now, who is going to be the subject to the self-ignorance? The one who is really the creation of self-ignorance. This creation of self-ignorance, what I mean is, until your mind, which itself is a product of ignorance, so we'll get to that later. Until your mind knows itself and the self, the fact of the matter is, your mind is never separate from consciousness. Right? Whatever the thought is, consciousness is there. The happy thought, consciousness. Right? Happy consciousness. Right? Depressed thought, depressed consciousness. We don't think depressed thought. We might, but what we mean is depressed me. Right? say, oh, I have a depressed thought, but what I mean is I am depressed. So when we can say that, I am depressed, that is the ignorance. That's the superimposition, you know. That's the cloud having now overwhelmed the sun. So the sun is now dark, right? So now here, if I say, this is the situation, no matter what the thought modification is, right, it enjoys consciousness. So consciousness, your being, let me put it in a more direct way. Whatever the thought is, it enjoys you. Right? You are not away from the thought. You can say, it's, and we even talk about it, it's my thought, this is my feeling, this is how I feel. Right? The I is always pervasive and present to the thought. And that's how we talk, this is my thought, this is how I feel, this is who I am today. just to emphasize the fact that the me, the self, is never not present. It doesn't matter what type of thought it is or what type of emotion it is, you are there. And because you are always there as the ongoing common denominator, you are never not there. And so therefore, there is, until it's pointed out to you, nothing to differentiate you from these coming experiences that are coming and going, because you are continually present to them without any change or modification whatsoever. And so you are basically unnoticeable. You are the unnoticeable continuum that is present, that you are the I, the me, the self, the unnoticeable presence that is present, pervasive to every single thought, feeling, mood, emotion that you have. And since that is constant and pervasive to every single thought, you don't notice the constancy of that. What you notice is what is changing. So there's the ongoing I, happy, I, sad, I, agitated, I, dull, I, smart, I, stupid, except on. See what I mean? You're noticing, you're going to be noticing the changes that are occurring in that constant. And so in your experience, it's just, now you're this, and 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 now you're this. It goes on and on and on and on and on. You don't recognize that the I remains constant as all of these states of experiences change. The one who is this, now is this. This is gone. This has come. See what I mean? The one who is this mood is the one who is this mood. This mood is gone. This is a new mood that has come. This mood is gone. A new mood has come. This thought has come. This thought is gone. A new thought has come. You remain the same. You don't come and go. And so what has to happen is that this self, which is the luminary, which is the sun of all of your experience, has to be differentiated. Who has to differentiate it? The mind, right? The mind needs to recognize that it itself, the mind's the clouds. The mind is what's being illumined. Everybody see that? The mind is what's being illumined. The ahankara has all, which is the I notion, has always identified with the mind, always identified with the experience. That's where the ignorance is. The ahankara identifies with the experience, with the object that's being experienced, instead of identifying with the self that's illumining the experience. This is what's going on. It is extremely simple. It's extremely simple. That's the problem with it. It's too simple, you know. And so we have to really unwind and unwind and unwind to get to this level of simplicity. But the simplicity, it's simple because it is just simply asking you to notice what's actually with the inner environment, what is actually going on inside, step by step. Like if I say to you, are you aware of your thoughts? You would say, would you say no? No. Are you aware of your emotions? Yes. Do your emotions come and go? Yes, but they tend to last longer than my thoughts. And I find I can even think when I'm in a given emotional state. I can be very sorrowful and thinking at the same time, or I can be very happy and thinking at the same time. But those emotional states, which I can think in, right, come and go. They change. I know that because I can say, yesterday I was happy and today I'm sad. Yesterday I was agitated, today I'm happy. Right? An hour ago I was really depressed. Thank goodness I'm out of it. Right? So these states of experience are known, right, to me. So we can say, yes, I'm aware of that. In fact, so many of you do vipassana. You just simply, one way of doing vipassana type of meditation, simply relax and be aware of your thoughts. All of them. Without interfering. Just keep quiet. Just relax. Let them be. And just watch them. Watch what they do. You watch them come. You watch all the multi-processing going on. You know, you watch them come and then go. They can be chit-chatting very wildly for a while. If you just watch for a while, they'll slow down. You'll watch emotional things happening. But you are the witness. You also notice. So this is a fact. This is inner environment. It's just noticing your inner environment. You know, you also notice as that environment changes, the one who's aware doesn't. Right? The thoughts are coming and going. You are not. You say, yes, that's true. Okay, this is, because there's nothing else to say. It's a fact. If you're aware of the thoughts as they change and you remain constant, illumining like the sun, illumining the thoughts, that's just how it is. Now, nevertheless, even though we say, yeah, that is how it is, why is it that the ahankara, the I notion, can still come along and say, I, the sun that's illumining the unhappy thought, the ahankara can come along and say, I am unhappy. Right? That's the hridaya granthihi, that's the knot of the heart. Right? I label myself as the conscious being, and then I lasso the thought and pull it into myself for me to become that for the moment. But in reality, I never become that. Never, at any time. And so, once that ignorance has been removed, it's delusional. It's, you know, once that ignorance that causes this delusion has been removed, one's inner experience is much, much different. Right? Because my mind now has recognized that I am the sun. I am the stable, conscious being that is present to and the luminary of all of the changing moods and emotions and thoughts. I light them up. And I, the constant conscious awareness, you know, light up these thoughts. I'm the conscious, timeless awareness. I light up all of these thoughts as they come and go. And the ahankara, the I notion, now rests with me, not with the thought. And so here in this verse, Hastamalika says, "Aham Atma, I am that Atma, whose swarupa, whose nature is timeless consciousness, changeless consciousness. And it is this changeless consciousness who appears to be bound by the one who is deluded. What is going to make me bound? It's the identification with the mind. That's the beginning. This identification with the mind. Right? Because then I become whatever I'm thinking. Right? Today I'm happy, tomorrow I'm sad, I'm agitated, whatever the thought is, I am that thought. Think of the nightmare. But I am that thought. No matter what the thought is, it's going to be temporary. If it's a happy thought, I am temporarily happy. You know? If it's a bad thought, I'm temporarily in pain. Unfortunately, when I'm in pain, I don't tend to think, oh, well, this is just temporary. That's really odd. But think about it. When I'm in pain because of the hurt of the situation, I don't think, oh, this is just temporary. But when I'm in a happy state, when the mind is in a happy state, I do think, oh, this is just temporary. Isn't that odd? If you're in a happy state, oh, this is only going to be temporary, which is true. Right? It's true. You're in a sad state. Is this only temporary, or is this going to be how it is? Okay. But in any case, there's no identification with my being, right? So this is where the ignorance has got to be removed, because I become bound by this ignorance. I'm not bound in reality. The sun never loses its luster. The sun never changes in any way, right? Nothing happens at all. But then I have to recognize this inner space. I have to recognize this internally. So a person can't just tell you this. It's not enough. You know, that's like saying, just like with the, that's why with the Advaita Vedanta is a pramana. It's a means of knowledge that takes place through the use of words. Means words have got to land. And then very meticulously make the mind see all of this. Because otherwise, how does this help you if the person says, your mind is changing, yourself is changeless. You're fine. Yourself is, you know, timeless consciousness. And your mind is always changing, so there's no problem. Okay? That's true. That's true. But what has to happen is that the mind has to see that is true. Not think that is true. It's nice to think that it's true also. But it's not thinking that it's true. It's not believing that it's true. It's seeing that it's seeing it that it's true. And then understanding what you're seeing. It's two things. You have to first see the fact of it, and then understand why that fact is true. Because otherwise you can see something and you say, well, I see it, but is that really the way it is? Right? That's legitimate. Okay, I see what you're saying. I see what you're saying. But is that really the way it is? Couldn't it also be like this? Right? That's what we mean by manana. When we talk about Advaita Vedanta, that whole teaching methodology, Shravana Manana Nididhyasana. Shravana means this systematic unfoldment so that you recognize the fact, whatever the fact is that the given verse is taking, and then one verse builds on another. You recognize it. You see it. Okay? But then you can say you see it, but then you say, well, could it be another way? Even though I'm seeing my thoughts, couldn't I still be my thoughts? I am the witness of my thoughts, but couldn't I still be it? Couldn't I still be the physical body, for instance? For instance, the physical body is stable compared to the thoughts, so why can't I be the physical body seeing my thoughts? So that's a doubt. That's where manana is necessary. Your mind needs to know, beyond any doubt, why what the Upanishad is saying is the truth. You see something, then that gives rise to another doubt, and then that doubt has to be answered so that your mind can truly know. See what I'm saying? That's why knowledge, why the Upanishads or this teaching is so, so very thorough, you know, and it has to unfold over and over and over again in many, many different ways, because if you see this as being true, the mind will then go, yes, that's true, but what about this? Couldn't it be this way also? That's why the shravana, manana, nididhyasana are necessary. What is the nididhyasana? The shravana is that using the words to kind of take you to see, to the seeing. The manana is looking at what you see from every conceivable point of view, bringing in all kinds of logics, you know, that could to negate the possibility of it being in another way. Nididhyasana is contemplation. It gives the mind a chance just simply to come into relationship with the conscious being that you are, kind of in slow motion. You know, to just be able to sit with yourself, to break that dehatma buddhi. Dehatma buddhi means that ongoing identification with the body or with the mind, that ahankara. To help the ahankara, the I notion, identify with the self. Instead of with the mind, or instead of with the body. Think about this. Just check for yourself. When you say, I am, me, these words, I am, or me, where does it land? Where does it land? You want it to land, or we want it to land, is in your being, which is changeless. Because your being, which is changeless, is the one always there, the you that's always there, no matter what the thought, no matter what the emotion. So when you say, I am, does it go to you? Or does it go to the superimposition? Like, for instance, superimposition means this. If your mind is agitated, now you have an agitated mind, which you are illumining, right? Which you are aware of. Right? You illumine, you're aware of an agitated mind. The ahankara comes and it says, I am. Where does that I am land? Does it land on you, the agitated person? Or does it land on you? And does the agitation remain as a state of mind? Which it is. It's not that, this is not saying that the agitated state of mind isn't there. It is there. Or the depressed state of mind, or the hurt state of mind. It is there, if it's there. Right? But where does the ahankara land? Does it land on yourself? If it does, then this state of mind is what you're living with at the moment. Right? This is the state of mind that you're illumining. Right? This is the state of mind then you can do something with. Right? You are you. Right? When this state of mind goes, you are still you. When the next state of mind comes, you are still you. You're the you're constant. And so now, think of this. This is now a state of mind. So it's an agitative state of mind. This is what I was doing a little bit in the meditation. Say as your knowledge is becoming clear, the recognition of just your being. Your mind is starting to just enjoy the differentiation between the constancy of your being, you know, and whatever state of mind it is. When the mind starts to enjoy that naturally, that this is the thought, and I am the one illumining the thought, right? Then if the mind gets away from itself, or it becomes upset or lost in the world, or so-and-so did something that hurt my feelings, and the mind is engaged in that, you know? So it's all tangled up. As that mind matures and begins to just recognize that I am always there, no matter how engaged or tangled up it is, once it recognizes I'm engaged, tangled up, in a mess at the moment, you know, this is a mess, right? You know, it will just draw itself back and just be with the self. It'll just relax in myself. Because there's certain things that it knows just by being with my own presence, who I am, having recognized myself. I am by nature changeless. I'm not going to change my mind. My being is as it is. My being is non-judgmental. My being is whole and complete. My being is my best friend, in a sense, without words. Not best friend. You have to be able to use lakshana here. Not my best friend is the self. It's not saying, ah, I'm your best friend. Not in that way. In the essential nature of your being, as just the wholeness, the consciousness, the non-judgmental being that you are, that being is always present to the mind. When the mind recognizes that, it can always retract, right, and relax in myself. There's certain things that the mind knows when, as knowledge becomes clear. There are certain things that it knows. One thing that it knows is this. All of the pain that I've just gotten myself into, I can unwind. I can unwind because the source of the ananda that the mind enjoys, right? All the mind need do is relax. That's all it has to do. It just has to relax in me, right? In the self. And then because that is the source of wholeness. There is no external source of wholeness. So the mind knows that. So all it has to do now is pull back and relax. That's it. If the mind doesn't know that yet enough, and the mind, you find, still has critical voice. That's why I say it's so important. Just sit with yourself and see, how do I talk with myself? How do I talk with myself? What type of an inner home, what type of an inner space is there? You know, if there's a self-deprecating, you know, or some a voice, self-deprecating voice, or a critical voice, or a non-understanding voice, or a voice that doesn't give the benefit of the doubt, if there's that type of self-talk, you know, that you can't just relax away, you can bring in another type of self-talk, you know, that says, no, that's okay. Just like going to visit a good friend instead of going to visit a person who doesn't like you. If you go to visit a person that doesn't like you, that is really a terrible experience. And you like it to last, you know, you like to minimize it. You know? You know? Sometimes we have those enemies inside, you know, from growing up and whatnot. And you can, sometimes you're not conscious of it. And so that's why I say, if you just give a little space to your mind to see if you have any kind of that negative self-talk, because just like externally negative self-talk, people that are talking negatively at you, you just want to run away. They just make you feel terrible. It just, you know, makes your mind tense. The same process can be going on internally, you know, because of by the what type of self-talk is there. So if that negative self-talk is there, you want to change it. And you can change it just by being aware of it and bringing in a friend. Just like you are a friend to other people, you can bring in a friend to yourself that will relax the mind. If that negative self-talk isn't there, and after a while it isn't there, you know, there's no need for it to be there. It can easily be, you know, if you work with it a little bit, you can easily get rid of that. If the negative self-talk isn't there, then your mind enjoys a natural relaxation, you know. And it has a natural well-being. And that mind can then just rest in the self. It gets lost out here or something, just rest in the self. You know, just bring it back. But there's no negative self-talk. Right? So that's why, you know, when some people have said, you know, what is this? You're using this inner friend idea. Right? If you use the inner friend. Why do you do that? It's not like, there's not a self. And then why do you have to have this, like this third party? Yeah, do we need the third party? No. We don't need the inner friend if that's natural. If that's the natural way that your mind is, if the natural internal mind, way the mind is benign, which there's no reason for it not to be, you know, unless it isn't. But if it is benign, then we don't have to bring in an inner friend to talk to it, because it's already fine. And that mind can just seek refuge in the self. If it needs to, if it's getting, you know, overwhelmed out here, for whatever reason, it's just simply relax into the self. That inner friend is so helpful if there's negative self-talk, or if you're getting bombarded by something negative outside, you know. Then the mind, that compassionate part of the mind, you know, that can help, that can bring in wisdom to the parts that are hurt, that's very, very valuable. You say, well, why do you say it's an inner friend? You don't have to say that, if it is an inner friend. If the way that you sort through your experiences is the way your teacher or your guru or Bhagawan would sort through the experiences, then it's fine. If the way your mind sorts through difficult experiences is like your abusive father, you know, then you need some help. Everybody see what I'm saying? You know, it shouldn't be too difficult, but just because some of these questions have come up, I just want to make it clear that it's not a matter of bringing in a second self, or that you need to have inner self-talk or not inner self-talk. You don't need it if you don't need it. You know. But again, when you think about it, when you are, life can be difficult and very challenging. You know, there's not always somebody outside to sort things through for you. So you're not always having an external conversation with people. That means you yourself internally are thinking things through, how to handle this, or what to do in this situation, or what happened here, you know? What just happened? What went on? So what I'm asking is that you notice how you negotiate, how you are with yourself inside. Usually we're not necessarily terribly conscious of that. What I'm saying is that if the way you have some control over that once you become conscious of it, so that the way you handle your inner life, the inner situation, is peaceful. It's an environment that you would love to have. It's kind. It's peaceful. If it wants to help, you know, that gives peace. That gives relaxation to the mind. Now, why is that important? Because it's a relaxed mind, right? That really naturally enjoys the fullness and wholeness and ananda of the self. And that relaxed mind is really not dependent on the world. You don't need the world for it. Just like on another level, the nature of consciousness does not require the world. It doesn't. The world cannot even be here. The world is cyclical. It doesn't need the world. The wholeness, the well-being of consciousness is totally independent. It doesn't need anything. To be, and to be the whole, full, infinite being that it is. You don't require anything to make your I, yourself, other than what it is. It doesn't need any support whatsoever. Now, the mind, its wholeness, right, is because of consciousness. Consciousness is its truth, its being, its reality. The mind is never away from consciousness at any time, ever. And all it needs for its fullness or wholeness is consciousness, nothing else. Right? And so the mind also is independent of the world in terms of I need this to be happy and I need this to be happy and I need this to be happy. The mind doesn't need anything to be happy. The mind needs to relax. It doesn't, the only reason it thinks it needs something to be happy is because it thinks I need this object in order to be happy, and if I get that, then the mind relaxes and I'm happy. What the mind needs for its wholeness and happiness is simply to be relaxed, because the source of its wholeness and well-being is the self, which is absolutely independent. So in a sense, the mind is very independent too, because the mind is never away from the self. Right? And so it doesn't need all these circuitous routes. But it has to understand all of this. You know, in order to, for it to have the, it needs the knowledge so that it can have the freedom to relax, because it's not going to relax off of a belief. It has to understand. And when it understands, then it can relax, because the source of its wholeness is something which is nitya. It's free from time. It's me. Nothing can take it away, ever. And so now there's just many, many different levels that we work on the mind to get it to relax. And as it relaxes, right, it's able to gain knowledge and gain clarity and have all of these doubts removed, right, so that it can just peacefully abide in myself and appreciate the world as it is, as Ishwara. Okay, so. Anyway, that was only one verse. But it's okay. We'll do the next one next week. Let's just take a minute. Purnamadah Purnamidam Purnat Purnamidachate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnameva Vashishate Om Shanti Shanti Shanti. That's a good, when we say the Ajnana Nivritti, that's in reference to knowing the self as consciousness. Because since the self experience is already present, you're not going to gain a vritti of it as though it's not there. So you're only removing the ignorance. But then in reference to, there's so much relative knowledge, understanding the nature of the mind, how the mind works, the nature of ananda, how happiness works, you know, just understanding relatively Ishwara and the mind's relationship to Ishwara, you can say in that way it's a gain of knowledge. You're gaining things that you don't know, you didn't know before.
But it says the removal of ignorance is only in reference to the mind understanding myself.
I think so, because, yeah, only in understanding, only in reference to consciousness, to consciousness. See, this, look, in terms of the use of a pramana, this is how it is. For, I'm just using my eyes. If I look at that painting, okay, I look at the painting, I need my eyes to see that painting, which is away from me, right? But when I use my eyes to see the painting, I now gain a thought modification of the painting, which wasn't there before. Right? The thought modification wasn't there before, so there was no possibility of my having knowledge until I gain the knowledge, gain the thought modification of the painting, and then I can know that. Right? Now, here, for self-knowledge, means gaining the nature of consciousness, of my being. It's different, because here, the consciousness is the one that is illumining the vritti. Right? So the consciousness, what needs to be gained, is already here. So it's not like having to bring an object into my purview so that I can know it. So now the consciousness is already here, right? So it doesn't need to be brought into my purview. And so what has to happen with the mind? It's not that the mind needs to gain an experience of consciousness. Consciousness is really the very substance, the very being of the mind. So what has to happen, we say, is the ajnana nivritti, the ignorance has to be removed. So it gets a little bit more, I can get a little bit more technical than that, but I think the best way to understand it is that in reference to self-knowledge, for self-knowledge, I don't have to bring the object of knowledge to me. Whereas for anything else, I have to bring the object of knowledge to me.
And then the removal of ignorance only happens, though, through gaining knowledge, because otherwise there's no tool.
Yes, there is, but you have to understand, yes, that's right, but you have to understand the dynamics are different between gaining knowledge of the self, because the object of knowledge is already here, and gaining knowledge of anything other than the self. Because that requires bringing that object into my consciousness through a vritti, through a means of knowledge. Here I'm using a means of knowledge, but not to bring the object into my consciousness. It's already there. Right?
So the removal of the ignorance is not taking the consciousness to be the mind and the body.
That's right. You recognize the independent nature of consciousness. Yeah. In fact, and you recognize all of this is nothing but consciousness. Starts out, you have to differentiate the consciousness from all of this, and then you recognize that none of this has any being apart from consciousness.
It's a helpful way to begin to see that. That your mind is lit up by consciousness. I mean, somehow to me that seems like, because your mind is an object in the creation, just as anything else is an object in the creation. Your mind is it's very personal. And so you can make that, you can understand that, oh, my consciousness illumines my mind. And somehow maybe there's some kind of jump then that you can make to the rest.
Yeah, well, in a sense, there's a jump, and we can definitely use that just as how awareness, me, the conscious being, illumines everything in the mind. So now, say if I have a thought modification of this room. Really, through my eyes, I am now having a vritti, a thought modification of the room. Okay? Everybody with me on that? Because if your mind is, the way to really understand that clearly is, if your eyes are now looking out and taking in whatever is in their sphere, however, if your mind is daydreaming, even though your eyes are looking out, the only thing that you illumine is whatever the mind is daydreaming. Right? So you won't be seeing anything. You'll just be seeing your daydream. So that means now the mind has a thought modification born of the sense perception through your eyes. And that means that this whole room that you're experiencing is a thought modification, which is pervaded by your awareness. The whole thought is known. And this is an awareness, this is an awareness, this is an awareness. The whole thought, completely, is in awareness. And so just between the relationship between consciousness and awareness, I mean, awareness and the mind, we can see the substrate, all-pervading nature of consciousness. In other words, my consciousness is not more to the right than it is to the left of the vritti. The whole thing is equally pervaded. But now, well, you're talking about a jump. Now we have to say, okay, yeah, but that's just the mind. What about out here? Which the mind is gaining the thought modification of something out here. Do these things out here have any substance of their own? Okay, so now, once we make that, we're out here, not just the vritti and the mind. Now we have a different logics that we have to go through, different means of analysis to to go through to show that there is nothing out here separate from being, where everything is infinitely divisible, the nature of time and all of that. There's all a lot of other logics that we use to analyze this creation to show that this creation has no substance or being away from consciousness.
But I always have this question with that, because the logics are logical and they make sense, and you can get to formlessness, and you say, well, how many kinds of formlessness can there be? And yet it's my understanding that it's actually experientially known that this is all myself, more than just derived after logic.
Yeah, but now what you're, this is a little mistake in your thinking you're making here. You're separating the logical analysis from your experience. The logical analysis is of your experience. It's not just in your head. Like, for instance, let me show you what I mean. If we do the seer-seen differentiation, that's logical. But it's asking you to see the reality of it. Like, it is true that I have a subject-object relationship with all of my things that I perceive, sense perception. And you can say, yes, that's true. Now, what if you say, yes, that makes sense logically? And that's all you do. That's not enough. It's not enough. You have to see that experience, that you do have experience. You have to see the fact that your five sense organs not only experience this physical world external to the body, but that these five sense organs experience this physical body. That's a fact. Does everybody see how that's, if you remove one sense organ at a time, your body is being eliminated experientially along with the rest of the world. So this body is known to you through the five sense organs. But that's an experiential fact. Now, this experiential fact has certain repercussions. It has implications that are logical. But those logical implications need to be seen in reference to the fact of your experience. Like one logical implication. My five sense organs experience all of these things that I call objects, the same five sense organs experiencing this body. Is this body not an object of my experience? Is it or is it not? Oh, you say, it is. Is this in your head or is this, see what I mean? Now when we, so all the way through it's like this. You see it, you understand it, and you understand the logical implications of that. Right? So it's the logical implications are very tied to the experience. Right? So it's the same now when we're looking at, like, the chair. If I say, this chair is by name only, so Swamiji, this chair is by name only. What does that mean? Well, it means that this chair is actually made of many different parts. You know, it's a conglomerate of many different things. You could say, okay, that's true, but it doesn't have that many repercussions yet. But then when you start realizing that this chair is infinitely divisible into smaller and smaller parts, and as long as small, I'll use the word form, smaller and smaller forms, now your mind has to see that as a fact. And it is a fact. This is not something to argue about, because we're talking more simply than that. There's no argument here. This breaks down into smaller and smaller forms. Right? It also is true, if we just look at the clay pot, that the form is different than the substance. The form depends on the substance for its reality, like the pot. I could make the pot into a plate, right? The clay is the truth of the pot, and it's the truth of the plate. It doesn't change. But the pot and the plate do. They don't have any substantial being or reality apart from the substance. It's just the nature of form. So now, what that tells me, though, is if I can divide the creation into smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller forms, I'm never saying anything about the substance. And not at all. Right. And the substance, then, is going to be, we have to take off the form. The substance has to be formless. But as we do this division, we have to be seeing, you know, what is left. You know, each time we divide the form into smaller forms, those forms exist, then those smaller forms exist, then those smaller forms exist, then those smaller forms exist. The only thing that remains as a constant is the substance, which is the being itself. Now, is the being, when you say exist, are you out here in your head, or are you here with the form which is? The experience of the form which is. So we have to always, you know, keep very rooted in the experience that we're analyzing and logicking around. Otherwise, it's off in your head. And
what do you mean off in your head?
You're intellectualizing without, you know, sounds good intellectually, but it's removed from
what I'm understanding.
The experience, not what you're understanding. What you should be understanding is experientially present. All of the logic, all of the analysis is on what is actually here experientially present. And it's easy to ricochet off into your head, you know, and then just think you're in some sort of a philosophy.
None of these objects. But then we have to go back and say, but I am all of these objects depend on
it. Okay, but look, when you do the subject-object differentiation, all that are objects get thrown back into the creation. The body, the mind, the sense organs, the ahankara, everything gets objectified. Then now it all belongs to Ishwara. It all belongs to the creation. Then awareness now is object-free. It's the subject. What is the relationship of the non-objectifiable me, the conscious being, to this creation of which the body, mind, sense organs, etc. belong? Now, does this creation, what they call Maya, does it have a being away from consciousness? See? You can Kiki and then Kiki and Paul.
You know, when we talk about, we say a lot about all the mind has to do to be happy is just relax. And it seems in a way that if we chase that directly, if the mind chases directly to be happy, and then you can remind yourself, oh, all you need to do is relax, it seems like it's the mind kind of gets more sort of caught up in that process and the need to be happy and the chasing happiness, as opposed to when the mind has discriminated itself, then that desire to be so happy just, you know, automatically sort of abates a bit, where this you know, this kind of need to be happy. And that seems like a much, I mean, then the process almost seems automatic, that after discrimination, there is automatic relaxation, so the mind is directly happy. So, and that, as opposed to, you know, this direct chasing to want to be happy and, oh, I just have to relax my mind. No, it just doesn't.
I think I'm using, the word happiness, again, I'm using as, that's why I always bring in these other words like wholeness or completeness. You know, I'm not looking for different bliss experiences.
Right, no, I want you.
But just the well-being.
I think I was asking more about, you know, your take on it, as opposed to, I don't think I was saying that this is what you say in class, but more...
My take on...
I think
that the greatest... I like the word ananda, swarupananda, which is the nature of the self is so whole and complete that is the greatest happiness that there is. But the thing is, when I use the word happiness, then we think of happiness as an extreme state that is not just the natural natural wholeness of myself. You know, or we think of love, we think of being in love, instead of just that, using those words as lakshanas means pointing to that condition of wholeness in yourself. And
but when you say that all your mind needs to do to be happy and the source of ananda is the self, at that time when you use that word happy, you are talking about the mental state of ingradiated happiness, right?
If I am I can be talking that way. So if I'm talking that way, then that's true. Just like from the standpoint of the mind, when I fulfill a desire, the mind at that time becomes quiet and it enjoys ananda or bliss or happiness that comes and goes. So that's true also. So when the mind relaxes, it enjoys relaxes even more, becomes more quiet, it enjoys more kind of bliss from its own standpoint. But I guess I'm used to thinking of happiness as just a natural, relaxed state of mind where the wholeness of yourself is just natural for that mind. And so that's the kind of the ongoing happiness of the self. But it's also true that to the degree the mind relaxes or becomes happy, becomes quiet, to that degree, from its own standpoint, it enjoys bliss, more bliss, more bliss, or happy, happier, happier, happier. You know, that's true also.
Right, but it seems like that state of the mind being relaxed to enjoy the bliss, you know, is hard to attain if you chase it directly, but as an automatic outcome of discrimination.
It is an automatic outcome. The relaxed state is an automatic outcome of knowledge. It's automatic. And we even say the state of mind or the relaxation of the mind itself is what we call a secondary gain. The primary gain is just the recognition of myself, the stable being that I am. That's moksha. And that stable being that I am is always the same. And it's whole and complete. You know? And the mind in its natural condition is not ever feeling away from that. Once that ajnana, that ignorance, is removed. You know, and so it just relaxes and it does, it lives its life. Yeah. Oh, Paul. Oh, wait. Go ahead.
Yeah, I hope I could articulate this well. At one point you were talking about perspective taking as part of this process on your way to the experience of self. And it sounds like the mind could be used in two ways. It could be used in a downward way to look at something less real, or you could attempt to apply it upward to higher ontological planes. But when you do this perspective taking where you see through the illusion that the thought could really have like a subject relationship to the object, and that's what allows you to transcend the thought instead of...
I think what the Vedanta is trying to point out is that the consciousness, right, is the ultimate subject, your being. Consciousness is the ultimate subject. There's not a mind that is also a subject to consciousness.
Except in a relative way.
Well,
if I'm seeing an object...
Yeah, relatively,
yeah,
relatively. Yes, that's right.
Yeah.
But the consciousness that you are, right, is always present to that mind. And it doesn't need the mind for it to shine.
Right. Right. Yeah, I guess what I was trying to say is that if I attempt to use my mind to grasp something as knowledge, and I take multiple perspectives on it, what I finally find in the end is that I can't. I can't get to...
Yes, the multiple
absoluteness.
That's right.
That exercise is what causes me to relax my attention and fall back into being, so to speak.
Because the multiple perspectives are true only within duality. You can have infinite perspectives within duality. But consciousness is not a perspective. Consciousness is the subject of all those perspectives. It's the non-objectifiable subject.
Right.
Yeah.
And I was a little confused because it seemed like you were using consciousness and awareness
synonymously.
Yeah.
I do.
Okay.
They mean exactly the same thing.
Two aspects of one.
No. Just the same. If I'm using consciousness and then using awareness, I'm using them the same way.
In an absolute sense.
In an absolute sense, yeah. Okay. Yeah, in an absolute sense, yeah.
Okay, that makes sense.
Yeah. Sorry. Yeah, that can get confusing. So, yeah. Paul?
Well, so one thing I just wanted to make an observation that you were talking about how, you know, that bringing that inner friend and then how, you know, if we have a negative interaction, we want to minimize those as much as possible. And one thing, at least I struggle with, is the fact that I do avoid conflicts,
yeah,
like actual verbal conflict, mm-hmm, as much as possible. But sometimes I notice, mm-hmm, that this internal voice that's very negative is there all the time. So I was just kind of acknowledging what you said and the paradox that I avoid it externally, but yet internally there's this.
That's a paradox, and we're not usually aware of it.
Right.
Until it's pointed out.
Right.
Yeah.
So that was very helpful. But the question I have is more related to when you understand or appreciate the understanding that our true being is happiness, and that the external world is these changing, these things that are subject to change, and this internal happiness is unchanging and constant and timeless.
I usually don't use happiness there. I use Swarupananda. I'd rather use that eternal being, because happiness to me means these happy states
like
of experience.
Saying, right.
Yeah.
So
I would rather say the wholeness, fullness, completeness,
okay,
of your being.
So when you have an understanding that you are this wholeness, this fullness, at least for me, sometimes what I've noticed is that I become somewhat detached emotionally, in that, you know, Swamiji told this story once of this family that he was close to for a long time, and their father passed away. Yet no one was devastated by the death because they recognized that it was death on the physical plane, but that their father really was not dead, so to speak. And in my day-to-day life, as I've come to appreciate this knowledge more and more, I've struggled with still being present emotionally for people because, for example, just recently my girlfriend and I broke up, and I was kind of able to just be okay with it. You know, I wasn't that emotionally devastated by it. And maybe that's just saying that I wasn't very emotionally involved in the relationship, but there's a part of me that just said, okay, well, this relationship is ending, but it's not that big of a deal. You know what I mean? So I'm struggling sometimes with being, what does it mean when you have this knowledge, but yet you still want to be emotionally involved with the world, but yet not caught up in it?
Well, see, I don't think this knowledge stops you from being emotionally involved in the world, but you don't have to be devastated by the world.
Mm-hmm.
You can love, but if the person that you love or the situation that you love changes, then it changes. You can let things come and let things go, but you can still be involved in them while they're there.
Yeah, I guess, you know, what I experienced in this tangible experience that I just went through was that was making the breakup even worse for my girlfriend, because she looked at me as just kind of this heartless bastard, really. You know, that I was not devastated by it. So this was kind of, I really struggled with it because...
Well, you know, I've heard that before, and I can understand that say if you have knowledge, you can fully, you can be fully engaged, fully love, maybe more freely than somebody else. But, you know, you also are free inside. Mm. And I think that can be disconcerting sometimes to people because they look for total dependence.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and if they don't have the total dependence on you, they don't feel that maybe you don't love them enough. You're not totally dependent on them. And so maybe it can be hard to be with somebody who's free, has some freedom inside, because even though they love you and care about you, the partner doesn't feel that you're emotionally dependent enough.
Mm-hmm.
And that's probably true. You're not emotionally dependent. And I think that's a great thing. You love and you depend on people. I don't mean that. You love and you depend on people. And you're relational. But is it a great thing to be devastated when the world changes? It's ridiculous. Do you want that? Is that a sign of love to you? I don't think so.
But yeah, what it means for me, you know, it's the same thing I think that I felt also initially, but I think that in a way it was more of, you know, I was kidding myself by trying to protect myself in certain circumstances from being hurt. It was almost more liberating to feel the hurt. To say, no, it's okay, I am hurt, and I feel the hurt, and that's okay. But, you know, there are some situations that warrant you being hurt. And, you know, that...
For Jnani, the hurt, it's like, like riding on water.
Well, that was something, not to interrupt you, but that I experienced here, that I had some self-doubt about, like, well, maybe I am kind of just this numb, emotionally void person that can't, you know, feel the pain of the situation.
Well, that's
and
something.
How do you discriminate?
Well, that's like, something to look at. You know, do I feel emotionally numb and void inside? Do I feel empty inside? Do I feel like I'm not capable of feeling? Is that how you feel about yourself? And then there's something to look into around that, right?
Mm-hmm.
'Cause you can say there's emotional bypassing there. I'm just shut down. That could be true. You know, and then that's something to kind of work through.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, you could really love somebody and the relationship is coming over. If you really love that person and that other person wants out, you'll probably feel hurt and you'll let it go, you know? But it could also be that that relationship is over and you're glad it's over and you're glad she's going. Sorry, but, you know.
Yeah, no, it can be both.
Yeah. And then you try to be as compassionate and loving and helpful as you can to your partner who you're splitting up with.
Mm-hmm.
Because she's more invested in it than you are. And if she's more invested than you are, then she'll think, what's the matter with you? Well, she's more invested than you are, and you don't care as much as she does. That's also samsara. That's also...
That's also a problem.
Yeah, and it's... Then, you know, our own kindness and compassion and change is hard, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Relationships are hard. Breaking up is hard. And one person is going to be more hurt than the other, usually.
But Carol, doesn't it really take a lot of emotional maturity? You know, you talk about that mental lag time. Doesn't it take a lot of lag time to really come to that point where you can accept a changing situation in a closed relationship? You know, supposing you lose someone who's very dear to you.
I think it takes a lot of maturity.
Yeah.
Yeah. And a lot of nishtha in this knowledge.
Right.
But I like what you say, too, that as you're maturing, if you have that certain attitudes inside that allow your mind the space to feel what it feels. You know, that's what I mean by inner friend. It doesn't have to be a voice inside, but it's an attitude that gives space to the mind to grow, to feel, to mature, to be what it is, you know? And you can give space to the mind to be what it is and to grow and mature and all of that when yourself is free.
It's very liberating.
It's very, very liberating, you know, because the mind doesn't just, boop, mature.
Yeah.
You know, it matures.
Sure.
Yeah. I mean, in light of this knowledge, it begins a process of maturing. But what this knowledge becomes a tremendous blessing, different stages of blessing along the way. you know, one is just that it's a huge relief when you recognize the difference between your being and the mind, you know, the sun illumining the clouds. It's another when your mind becomes a friend to itself, where it allows and enjoys the maturing process of the mind without trying to, like, rip open the rosebud, you know. It allows the mind to mature, you know, without being so judgmental or critical, but being more of just a support.
That state of mind is just a direct result of, you know, that space in the mind, and that, you know, what you call attitude, it seems like it's not even an attitude, it's just sort of a natural result of discrimination. Once you are not so invested in, you know, you don't get so tied up with your mind.
Well, yeah. Once that's so, you don't even notice it as an attitude or anything else, because it's natural. You don't think of it as an attitude, but when it starts out, it's usually an attitude or a new way of looking at things.
So you're saying that it can be directly developed as an attitude until the discrimination comes, and then it becomes natural.
When it's natural, once it's natural, you don't usually call it an attitude,
right,
because you don't notice it.
Yeah, we were talking about all this in relationship to relationship, and I could imagine where one could be in a certain space that they could automatically let go all the emotions. What I find for myself, and I'm just curious to hear your comment on it, is I might be in the situation of this gentleman, and my initial reaction will be to be really pissed off, so I'll own the anger, and I'll try to fill it fully, and ultimately it will transform, say, into sadness or hurt, which I'll also try to fill fully, and then that'll go somewhere else, and then eventually it'll get to something bigger. But I'm not sure I could jump directly to the something bigger. It's as though I have to go through all those things fully to get there.
But I don't see anything wrong with that. The only little thing I'm saying that makes that absolutely fine is when your self-talk or the way you hold your mind allows you to do that process, you know, allows you to be with that process and respect it, respect the mind and allow it to go through that. All the while, yourself is there blessing that whole process, yourself being the conscious being that you are.
I might not be very aware of it, but in some of those times, I mean, I feel like 2 years old and I just trust the confusion.
Yeah.
Like it's okay to be confused.
Yeah. I like that. Yeah, that's right. That means that the self-talk or the way you handle your mind is very healthy.
You know, Carol, you sometimes we talk about the different misconceptions people have about self-knowledge and stuff like that. And I think a pretty prevalent common one these days is the minute there's some kind of shift to recognizing the self, everything is absolutely rosy. Mm-hmm. You know, kaboom, you are a jnani and, you know? And I mean, I think in Vedanta, you know, this talk of Pratibandha Kanyana, I think it's really useful because I think that's a really big misconception.
Yeah, because it creates a lot of phonies. Because you have to walk around trying to be happy all the time because you're enlightened, you know? So now we have to kind of walk around in this exalted state. It's really, really unfortunate.
Don't mess with Mayananda.
And then also, I think it can also create a lot of problems for people who aren't mature and who've declared themselves as jnanis. And then they have all kinds of, like, really actual emotional immaturities going on that are, you know, creating havoc.
Can't it just not be identified with it? I mean, I heard Houston Smith say that someone was trying to heckle him, and he paused, and they asked him, what's the meaning of life? And he said, I suppose it's the joyful participation in the suffering of the world, but, you know, there's the aspect of it, even if one were enlightened, that maybe they could be in a difficult emotion, but it's like they have the emotion. The emotion doesn't necessarily have them. There's something
that's
bigger,
right,
holding it.
Yeah, that's right.
It's all about attachment.
But
that's nice.
Somebody like Swamiji, I guess for somebody like him, I mean, maybe it's not your right imagine he probably had such a healthy upbringing and stuff that maybe, do you know what I'm saying? That maybe when he had self-knowledge, he didn't have so many difficulties to go through that.
He had it easy. No, I'm kidding. Actually, he had a pretty tough childhood. But I think it is true. He will even say himself that from a young age, he's always just a very, very compassionate, very big hearted person. Beautiful person.
Does he express, speaking of emotional involvement, does he express emotions? I mean, like, does he get volatilely angry or,
I think that's the image. That's why people get confused, because they see somebody like Swamiji. You know, they see it, and that's what people read, and that's what people imagine as their own test. You know, if I have knowledge, why am I being angry? Why am I being hurt? Why am I being, you know, this, that, or the other?
That's why it's so important to understand all of the dynamics.
But you know, even when Tomas asked Swamiji a question, the question Tomas asked him was, can Vedanta become a popular teaching? Swamiji said no. But further on, Swamiji said, I went through a lot, but it was all worth it. And I don't know specifically what he was referring to. I think my impression was he was referring to all those years where he was kind of trying so hard.
He was trying so hard, he says he'd lost his hair.
Structures of consciousness that are progressively deeper and deeper and deeper, like in the sense that, okay, I could be relatively enlightened, but there's some fundamental structures of my consciousness that are in relative reality, but it's that subject out of object, you know, regressive type thing, where I could be relatively enlightened, but still get, you know, angry that some enlightened masters just, there's that last layer or whatever, just the structure that their personality, so to speak, personality is the wrong word, or their essence shines through, or the Atman shines through that last layer or whatever, could have some.
We'll talk about that later, but just because it's too much to get into right now, but just quickly, layers of consciousness, we don't accept anything like that. Because consciousness is only one pure consciousness. Okay, so there's no layers. But there are, in your mind, like there are a lot of layers in your mind. You know, in the unconscious, there's lots of layers and that type of thing that we work through a lot of things. And when your mind matures, you know, you there are layers of maturing, we could say like that.
Yeah.
But there's not layers of consciousness.
But you know, my point was kind of like there are different enlightened masters who have different, personality is the wrong word, but the divine could shine through them. So in a different way, because we're still experiencing.
No, I mean, we would say more like this, just to keep it in Vedanta language so that you can pick it. All of us, say, here in this, 10 of us in the room, or how many, we're each unique in terms of our personalities, our past, our temperament, you know? Now, with each one of us, say if your mind is really mature, you have self-knowledge, no paribandhikagnan, you really have self-knowledge and your mind is very mature. Nevertheless, the expression of that is going to be unique for each person. You know, and the way the personality is, the way, you know, if you're really extrovert, if you're introvert, or if you're a little kind of an ordinary type or a jovial type. Say a person's a real jovial type before they get knowledge. They'll be a really jovial type. You know what I'm saying? And say they're kind of a cranky type, you know, or irascible type. That could still be there, even though it won't have the edge on it.
Yeah.
You know?
That's what I was trying to say. But
yeah.
How do you explain that in Advaita Vedanta terms? I mean, there's still some kind of form there.
Yeah, because the form will be there as long as the body is there. You will have a body, mind, sense organs as long as it's here. The self is the one that yourself is changeless.
Right.
Right? But the body, mind, sense organs, as long as it has the karmas that will take you through to the death, that will remain. It's just that that body, mind, sense organs recognizes the changelessness of your being.
But won't there be a certain point in your gaining this knowledge where being ornery or angry will just, it will be clear that it's not necessary?
Well, I meant kind of an irascible personality, but yeah, it's hard to see how the anger can really be there, because there's no real reason for it. You can have maybe some sort of anger, but it's not going to be.
I mean, but yet I guess there's, you know,
maybe
plenty of examples of, you know, enlightened teachers that were very, you know, kind of, you know, martial in their.
But that's what I'm talking about as a personality type.
Right.
Yeah.
Depends how you define anger too.
Thinking earlier, even love, because we all have our own interpretation and use of it based on our experience of life and other lives, and you can't even rely on somebody else's interpretation of you, really.
Yeah, that's right. Oh, well.
Stop here.